Thanks so much for joining us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, on a clear night, you can see countless stars, and if you know what to look for, you might see planets, you might see falling stars, comets, lots of other cosmic events. And today we're talking about space, astronomy, and what the most powerful telescopes are constantly revealing about the universe. And we'll talk with a couple of guests for you today. From the UW Space Place, Director Jim Lattice with us. Jim, good to have you back.
Morning, Larry. Glad to be here.
Also with us today, astronomer, author, and podcaster Dean Regas. His podcast is titled Looking Up with Dean Regas, and it's produces that for Cincinnati Public Radio. Dean, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
Great to have you with us. Well, as we talk with our two experts, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about maybe planetary alignments or maybe what makes a dim star shine brighter or how solar flares affect the northern lights? We can talk about all that and a whole lot more. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Jim, let's start with you. On Tuesday, July 11th.
Ninth.
Ninth, is it? Oh, I had the date wrong. The UW Space Place Outreach Center will be holding an open house.
Well, that's right. We'll have our... have our guest speaker, who will be none other than Dean Regas, on Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. on the 9th.
Yeah, I'm going to ask Dean what he's going to talk about. But when people come to an open house, what do they typically see?
Well, this is Space Place is partly a museum and partly an outreach and event center, small events. So we're not Monona Terrace or anything. But we have a large exhibit area with museum quality exhibits from the history of UW astronomy and current science in UW astronomy. And so usually what happens is people have access to the exhibit area for a little while, and then we have our presentation, which on Tuesday night will be Dean. And that's and then of course there's always time for questions and then the exhibit area is open also after the presentation.
Yeah, it's really cool to visit. I've spent some time there with my daughter, and I've always enjoyed it. Dean, what are you planning to talk about at the event?
Well, this will be, I think, my third time coming back there.
That's
right.
And
it's a great place to go. And so my topic is going to be Fly Me to the Moon. And we're going to be talking about the Apollo mission, sending Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and company out there to the moon. And then looking ahead to future missions as well. So since this will be on July 9th, it'll just be about 11 days before that big anniversary when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon, July 20th, 1969. So it's still, even, you know, 50 some years later, it is still part of our, I think, our national identity and part of our adventurous spirit. So I always like looking back at those and then looking forward and maybe see who the new astronauts are going to be coming up.
Well, that's the thing to me is that we're thinking about this a whole lot again because the NASA Artemis program is in full swing right now. If the schedule is still a little bit uncertain, but the plan is to send people back to the moon, first time since the Apollo astronauts. So yeah, I'm really excited about this. I think this is a Dean's talk here will be a great way to get us back into the mindset of having people on the moon.
Yeah, that's really great. And I'm old enough to remember watching Walter Cronkite.
Sure. Yeah, I remember that too.
oh my goodness me. Well, you know, Dean, in 2020, you had an expanded edition of your book, 100 Things to See in the Night Sky. I think it was published in 2020. What are you currently observing or looking forward to seeing through your telescopes?
Oh boy, this is summertime is a great time to do stargazing, and I'm the author of 6 books, and that one is called 100 Things to See in the Night Sky. That one tells you how to find things season by season. And for me, how I got started in this business was I didn't know anything. I am not I'm a completely self-taught astronomer. I started working at a planetarium basically because nobody else wanted to, and they said, "Dean, you're in charge." And that's where I had to learn the night sky. And so that's why I wrote that book, was to kind of show how I went from not knowing anything and how I learned to navigate the night sky, because it can be kind of intimidating looking up there and seeing all these dots. So looking for basic real easy stuff, like things like called the summer triangle. That's the three brightest stars up in the eastern sky all summer long. Really great to look for. And then there's the Scorpius and Sagittarius down the southern sky to look for. And then you can get out a pair of binoculars and start scanning around too. But I think the big thing is to get through that initial intimidation factor of thinking, there's no way I can identify these things up there. And just getting a few footholds in there with the Big Dipper, with the summer triangle, and then it'll just start opening up for you, and you'll get hooked. That's the only problem, is that you're going to get hooked on astronomy. So just get ready for that. But it's a great season to start doing that.
That'd be a good problem to have.
Yeah,
Okay.
summer is a great time of course, lots of reasons. You have to stay up a little later. It doesn't get dark until a little bit later. And this summer in particular, we actually don't have any bright planets. We do our astronomy department does a Universe in the Park statewide Universe in the Park programs all summer, and those usually the first thing you'll look at is whatever, Jupiter or Saturn, some bright planet. But we don't have those, and so this summer, we will next summer. But we've got to move on a little bit more. I was testing a new telescope in the driveway the other night, and one of the little girl lives next door came over, saw the telescope, and came over. So, well, no planets, sorry, but I can show you some nice double stars, which are easy to pick out in the sky. Like Dean said, you can kind of work your way through constellations to find things that aren't planets, but you can still see from even the middle of the city nice double stars and star clusters and things like that.
In July, there's Joel was telling me there will be an occultation of the star Spica?
An occultation.
Yes, I'm sorry. By Earth's moon. Is that something we see? Occultation?
With that, I don't. Yes, no, normally you can see an occultation if we're on the right side of the Earth at the right time. So,
what is an
occultation? Oh, sorry. In that case, it almost surely means, chip in on this, Dean, if I'm wrong, but it's an occultation by the moon. The moon moves in front of a bright star. Spica is a bright star in the constellation Virgo, which is low in the western sky in the evenings these days.
Absolutely. This is one I've been kind of had on my radar just recently because, yeah, the moon will slide in front of these stars occasionally, but usually not some of the brighter ones. And Spica is the first magnitude, one of the brightest stars in the nighttime sky. And so on the night of July 13th, the moon will just cover it over. And so one moment you'll see this little star, this bright star next to the moon, and the next moment it's gone, just like that. Be behind the moon for about an hour. So that's on the evening of the 13th, and visible from most of the United States, including up there. So definitely something to put on your calendar, because you can see it with the naked eye, just flicker out, gone, and then come right back out an hour later. And they're very rare. I've hardly seen any of them of bright stars like this.
That's pretty cool. So that is, what day is it again?
July 13th. So that
July.
night, that evening.
In the evening,
I have
yeah.
the timing down for Cincinnati, but it's a slightly different for you all up there in Wisconsin. But that evening, boy, well, I can check, but it's in the, I think around the 10 o'clock hour, somewhere in there is when it goes out.
Yeah, Spica goes down reasonably early, so it's going to have to be still in the early evening.
Let's see. We've got, I'm just going through some things in my own head. The Perseid meteor showers. It comes up in mid-August.
Yep, mid-August is the peak.
And that could be one of the best shooting star displays this year, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, typically the Perseids are one of our better ones.
Yeah.
It's always our hope. And so, yeah, meteor showers are always fickle beasts. Like, you never know what's going to show up or how many shooting stars you'll see. I would say most people, I hate to tell people, most people are usually disappointed by meteor showers because they go out and they go out early and they think, oh, I'm going to see like the sky falling and everything. So a typical Perseid shower, I consider it a success if you see about 12 shooting stars an hour or something like that, about once every 5 minutes or somewhere around there. So I always try to get people to lower their expectations, but still get out there to see it, because even if you don't see some shooting stars, you'll still be able to see some nice stars and do some stargazing while you're at it.
It depends a lot on just where you go. You want to find a dark sky location if possible, and you'll see much fewer in the city where there's light pollution, and a lot more if you get out into a dark sky, because most of the meteors are dim.
I can remember a late night in the Shawamigan National Forest in November, and I saw many more than one every 5 minutes. there was no light.
It's probably a cold one too. That's the pluses of the Perseids. You know, August 12th, August 13th, you get a little better weather. But so if you think back to your childhood and time's getting away, you might see some shooting stars. So August 12th, 13th. A good shot for it.
What causes the shower to come by every year?
Yeah, this is from a comet. So a comet passes by and leaves a tail behind. So it leaves particles from this comet. And so that orbit of that comet is pretty steady. So every year the Earth passes into the remnants of this comet. And it's like it slams into this debris, and the debris just falls as shooting stars. And most of these are really small particles, you know, the size of a grain of sand, and they burn up in the atmosphere. Almost none of them would make it all the way to the ground, but you see it for those brief moments streaking across the sky.
It's amazing that the light that can come from something that small.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of energy there. Those things are going at, 50,000 miles an hour or something like that when they cross into the Earth's tens of thousands, we'll say, miles an hour when they cross into the Earth's atmosphere. So they release a lot of energy all at once. And so, yeah, that's where you get that flash in the sky. And it's this point in space where the Earth's orbit more or less intersects with the comet's orbit. It's not... the comet's orbit is kind of extended, or the comet's zone where it's left debris, like Dean was saying. But we encounter that place in our orbit on an annual basis, of course, because that's what it means for the 1 year to pass. So we annually go through these clouds, and if we get through the dense ones, we get a really good meteor shower. It also helps when the moon cooperates. The moon should be pretty good this year. That is pretty good at staying out of the way. It's going to set early in the evening, so we'll have a dark night that night.
Our guests today, Jim Lattice, director of the UW Space Place, Dean Regas, author, YouTuber. His podcast is titled Looking Up with Dean Regas, produces that for Cincinnati Public Radio. I'm Larry Miller. You're listening to WPR News. We're taking a look at what you can see in the night sky in the summertime with our guests, Jim Lattice and Dean Regas. Great to have you listening in. Questions for our guests, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Skip and Milton, we'll go to you now. Hi, Skip. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks, Larry. I just got on the show late, but I got on right away, so I'll have convenient. Want to share an experience I had over 50 years ago. It was the Perseids meteor storm, not shower, but storm. That's what Sky and Telescope and Astronomy Magazine described it as, and it really was. We were, it was the new moon, perfect conditions. We were there for the peak of the shower. We didn't even plan it that way, but it turned out that we were there in the right place. In Colorado, Mount Zirkle Wilderness area, and we were at about 11,000 feet, the new moon, so there's no light pollution there. You're miles away from the nearest small town. and it was breathtaking. We'd see sometimes two or three simultaneously at the same time. They were just zing, 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 and it took our breath away. It was a bolide that exploded, and it lit up the mountains for like 15 seconds. It was just broke into thousands of pieces. It was just, it was hard to believe what we were seeing. It was just so incredible.
Oh man, Skip, thanks for calling.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. I've seen a Leonid meteor storm a few years ago. Around 2000, we had a couple of years of Leonid storms, but seeing those things are pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully a lot of people got to see the total solar eclipse in April, and then hopefully you guys got to see the Northern Lights in May. I'd say a meteor storm is definitely in the top three of the thing to see in the night sky. They're very rare. I think Jim's right. The last one was the Leonids in 2001, but that's so cool to have that experience. And so, you know, things come in threes, right? So we had solar eclipse, Northern Lights. Then of course, you know, it's natural. We're gonna have a meteor storm, right? Yeah, or nova, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe.
Oh man. Well, Skip, what Skip described is kind of what I was seeing in the Shawangunk National Forest. There would be two or three at a time that you'd be seeing in the sky. It was.
So that's getting up there where the skies are dark.
Pitch dark. Yeah. There were no lights.
Yeah,
and
that helps a lot.
Oh, it was breathtaking. Skip, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Don in Iron River will give you a chance. Hi, Don.
Hey, Don here. Hey, is there going to be any reports of Northern Lights here in Wisconsin for the next couple months?
You're up in Bayfield County.
Well, it's next couple of months. There's a pretty good chance, but they don't forecast those more than a few days in advance because it depends entirely on what's going on the surface of the sun. But we're still in the middle of the solar max period. We just missed one a couple of days ago, and it was mostly it was daylight over here. They got a really good auroral display in Europe and Asia. So it also depends on us being in the right place at the right time. So the easiest way to keep checking, what I suggest people do is look at a website called spaceweather.com. And I check that every morning to see whether there are any particle clouds on what they call CMEs, coronal mass ejections, on the way that might hit the Earth. And those are the things that bring about the auroral displays.
Spaceweather.com. Is the place
all
to go.
One word, space weather.
Mm-hmm. Don, something to check for sure. Patrick in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. Yeah, I'll have to plug spaceweather.com too. It's one of my favorite websites. It's got incredible information on it, including there's a supernova forecasted to happen any day now. Could you explain a little about that, please?
Sure. It's not a supernova, so astronomers use those terms differently. This is called a recurrent nova, the thing that's in the news a lot just lately. And it's important to realize that we've only got accurate 1866 and 1946, we only have those two actual scientific observations, that you might say, of this recurrent nova. Which, though, is showing signs based on the 1946 data, it's showing signs again of being right before an eruption. These are actually fascinating star systems. It's a pair of stars, one of which is a red giant star, and matter is, at least this is the theory about what's going on there, the matter from the red giant star is being sucked over onto the surface of a white dwarf star. And this... basically, it's all hydrogen. This layer of hydrogen builds up on the surface of this white dwarf star, and at a certain temperature and density, it will explode and produce a lot of light. It doesn't destroy the star, either one of them, although that can happen in some situations like that. But in this case, the white dwarf is not destroyed. It just burns off all of a sudden this hydrogen, and we see that flash in the sky. And then after another 80 or so years of siphoning matter over again, that critical mass of hydrogen is accumulated there, and then it explodes again. So that's the recurrent part. And because most of the time the star is pretty dim, when it suddenly appears bright in the sky, they call that historically, people have called those new stars. We didn't see it yesterday, but there it is now. So this one is in the constellation Corona Borealis. And if it happens, now this, again, we're basing this on just a couple of past appearances of it, and maybe we don't have the behavior of it nailed down exactly, but yeah, it could happen sometime between now and the end of the year. We can't really put too small error bars on this. We just have to keep looking up. And Dean's book will tell you how to find Corona Borealis. You look high overhead in the summer sky, and if a star appears there that wasn't there the night before, then we may have seen what they're calling T, the letter T, Coronae Borealis is the name of this the star that I looked last night. I look every night, take a look up there maybe a couple of times just to see whether it's popped up.
And sometimes
things that, you know, we've never seen a nova like this in our lifetime. I mean, this takes a star that you can't see with the naked eye and makes it about as bright as the North Star. So it is pretty dramatic. I'm glad Jim is not so sure of the timing as we think it is. I always see that on the internet, like, oh yeah, it's going to happen anytime between now and September. And I said, well, okay, sure, we've seen it twice, so is two times enough to tell the pattern? We'll find out. So, whatever it is, it's got me looking too.
They're called it's called a blaze star too, isn't it? Another name for it?
That particular one is called the blaze star. Yeah, so you can look for it under that name. I noticed that Stellarium calls it that. So, yeah, that's kind of a colloquial name for it. In the star catalogs, it's the letter T, Coronae Borealis, whatever you like.
Leslie in Cottage Grove emailed us to say they've read the nova will be so bright it'll be visible during the day.
No.
Yeah, that one's a little too far off. Yeah, so, I mean, if you think of the North Star, which is not the brightest star in the sky, that's on the second tier, second magnitude stars, it's something that, yeah, it was not going to stand out compared to the rest of it. But if you take a look at the constellation Corona Borealis, there's seven stars that are just, six of them are just barely visible to the naked eye. One of them's a little brighter. This new nova will be as bright as, well, possibly as bright as the brightest star in Corona Borealis, which isn't that terribly bright. So only nighttime. Just keep your eyes open and watch social media too. They'll probably be posting when it happens.
Talking with Jim Lattice and Dean Regas about the night sky, you can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org.
Say, can I just jump in real quick with the times?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I forgot all about that.
So the subject of the occultation of Spica came up.
We were talking earlier.
Yeah, and so I just checked when I had a minute here. The occultation is going to happen about in Madison about 5 minutes after 10 p.m., about 10:05 on the 13th of July. So you want to be out there by around 10. And you'll see, like Dean described, you'll see Spica there just to the east of the moon. And as you watch, the moon will approach and then block out Spica, assuming we're not having a thunderstorm at the night.
Which is always a distinct possibility these days.
These days, yeah.
For sure. Starting yesterday, I think it's a comet that hasn't been visible since 56. You can see through binoculars and telescopes. I think it's, Olbers?
Olbers, 13P Olbers. Yeah, that's right. Right, so these are, you know, comets actually come along more frequently than people realize. There's usually a comet in the sky at one time or another. It's just that most of the time they're way too dim, even to see sometimes with telescopes. but they track them through the solar system. But then when they rise up to just enough brightness to be theoretically visible to the unaided eye, then they start calling them bright comets. And so this is actually kind of misleading, because it does lead people to think I should be able to walk out there and look over in the evening sky. So this one is a bright, quote-unquote, comet, but it's just now reaching really binocular visibility. So it's over in the over in the west, in the vicinity, pretty near the horizon, right after sunset, and it's pretty hard to describe how to look for it. There's no real bright objects real nearby, so probably the best thing to do is to look for a chart on the internet, or use a piece of software like Stellarium, or there's all kinds of them on your phone to guide your binoculars over. You're not going to see it unless you got really good eyes in a really dark sky. It's going to take binoculars to see this comet. But it is one that we've had. We had another one back earlier in the spring that was a nice binocular object and was getting a lot of press because the telescope pictures of it. This was the one that had devil's horns on it. There was a lot of there was a lot of excitement about that. But those are binocular comets. You really need to work to find those. They don't jump right out in the sky. But yep, 13P Olbers is over there.
Bruce in Monona will give you a chance. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. The aurora on May 11th, I was photographing for 3 hours on the shore of Lake Monona with the Madison skyline below. And for the first 2 hours, I was only seeing the pink and green. And then all of a sudden, blue showed up in my camera, and I was flipping out. But then at 3:41... the International Space Station came through it as well, along with the Big Dipper's also in the frame and all the shots. It was just spectacular. And a friend told me that the blue was nitrogen, green was hydrogen, and pink was oxygen, and that the nitrogen, the blue you see rarely because it's in the stratosphere, not the ionosphere or something. But my real question for you is, in terms of converting my raw files, is there an accurate Kelvin degree temperature that I should use so I'm getting accurate color? And apparently, you can't see that. I couldn't see the blue. It was just remarkable.
Mm. Dean, do you want to take a crack at that?
Yeah, this is a tough one, because when you photograph it, this was my experience. So in Cincinnati, we had, we're farther south, we're at 39 degrees latitude, and we had aurora show for just about a half hour that was visible. And so I got a text from a buddy and said, they're happening right now. And I was like, what, because you get these reports and you think, all right, well, maybe. We haven't had auroras in Cincinnati since 2001. And so I pop outside and I could see it up there as a little pink in the sky. And then I take my phone out and take a picture of it. And then the picture on my phone is like, holy moly, wow, that's way better than the real thing. And so your phone is taking a longer exposure, especially if you have some of the newer phones. And so that's the thing is, so if I was telling people around Cincinnati, is like, it didn't look as good as my picture. So trust me. So what do you do? And I'm glad you said that you didn't really see the blue, but your camera did. And so that's the thing, is you really just have to kind of experiment with it and try different settings. Each one has its own different thing, but it is kind of important to let people know the camera wasn't quite what you saw with the naked eye. It still is one of those most incredible shows, and let's hope for another one this summer too. That would be great to do that. Maybe when I'm up there visiting, that'd be even better for July 9th. So maybe, Jim, we can arrange some Northern Lights up there in Madison.
I'll do all I can.
All right.
So just on the photography question, I don't know whether you can play with the color temperature, but all of that, what that means is that's referring to what you would call a thermal source, a thermal glowing object like a light filament or something along that line. And those spectral, the auroras are spectral lines. It's not a thermal source at all. They're just intense radiation at very specific lines related to, as you said, hydrogen or oxygen or whatever in the Earth's atmosphere. So it's kind of up to you, whatever gives you the best results. And try, if you're trying to approximate what you saw by eye, then you're just going to have to play with it until you get it where you like it.
Yeah. Bruce, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Lyle in the town of Sun Prairie. Hi, Lyle.
Hi, Larry. I wanted to share an experience. A friend of yours, Lil Klesig, and I did wilderness canoe trips for 30 years. And one year we drove to central Ontario, floated down a river for several miles, a portage, and then camped on an island about 2 miles or about a mile out into this lake. And at dusk, to the left, you could look at about a 30-degree arc of the northern lights, but then they're totally reflected in the calm lake.
Nice.
If you look to the right, there's a total eclipse of the moon, also reflected back in the calm lake. And there's no way to share that. You couldn't pass on any video. It was just a total experience for about an hour and a half. And Lowell and I were memorized, and it was a very late night getting in the tent.
Oh, man, that sounds great. I bet Lowell sat there with his mouth open.
those kinds of things, you know, it's you could plan the lunar eclipse, but you can't plan the aurora. And so to luck into a situation like that, but you know, it isn't totally luck either. You have to be a little bit prepared for that. You've got to be aware of what's going on in the sky and be out there looking. And so Dean and I both often sign things, keep looking up. And I'll speak for myself. I mean that literally, you know, that when you're out in the night sky, study what's overhead, you know, study what stars are up there and things. And then you're a little bit prepared when the really amazing stuff comes along.
And I would just, Lyle, I was myself on a fishing trip in the far north and was asleep. I woke up and then I remembered I'd forgotten something in my boat, and I went down to the shore to take care of it and was treated to the aurora. And the reflection on the lake, it was a perfectly calm, you know, late at night, early morning, and just sat there and watched for a long time. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, they're fascinating, aren't they? Yeah.
And I didn't have a camera with me.
So I'm sensing a cultural difference from Cincinnati to Madison. So your nighttime stories all involve fishing trips, and the nighttime stories in Cincinnati all involve this saying: I was outside at night in the hot tub when I saw. I kid you not. I've had so many hot tub stories. I saw a shooting star in a hot tub. I saw you. So. I figure you guys have plenty of hot tubs up there, so there might be some hot tub stories too. I don't know.
No doubt.
I did sit in the hot tub in Tucson, Arizona one night with some friends, and it was in a night when there was a meteor shower, and we would every half hour somebody would say, "Oh, I think there was one."
Whatever gets you outside at night, I'm all for it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Lyle, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us. Love to hear from you. What's your experience or what questions do you have? Email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the sky today with our guests, Jim Lattis, director of the UW Space Place, Dean Regas, author, YouTuber, his currently co-host of our hosts, the Looking Up with Dean Regas for Cincinnati Public Radio. So great to have them both with us. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Mary emailed to ask, what size of binoculars and what size manufacturer of telescope that you guys might recommend for getting further into astronomy? So binoculars.
Oh, yeah. For binoculars, so there's the sizes that you see there. There's usually two numbers on the binoculars. The first number is how much it magnifies. So let's say you have a binoculars. It's where I usually like to start with is some that are like about 10 by 50s. So that means they magnify 10 times and the lenses on them are 50 millimeters or about 2 inches across. So the bigger the lenses, the more you could light you can gather, the farther, the more fainter things you can see. So bigger is always better until you can't hold them up with your hands any longer, that they're too heavy. So 10 by 50s, I think, are a good place to start. And then if you think, okay, I can handle a little more weight, then you can go up to ones that are about 15 by 70s. That means the lenses are 70 millimeters. And then there's even bigger ones than that. So I think those are, as far as brands go, there's lots of different good ones. I'd say it's hard to pick one or pick a type of brand, but you can always read reviews. Reviews are really good when it comes to that kind of thing because they're brutally honest about those things. So check those out online. But 10 by 50s, I think, are good ones to start with for binoculars.
Yeah, so that's those are a little bit, I would call those a little bit high power for general purpose binoculars. They're good astronomy binoculars. A lot of people have 7x35s. That's probably the most common configuration.
Yeah.
So a lot of people have to just have a pair of binoculars. It's likely to be 7x35. Use those.
If you got them.
If you got them, yeah, use them. And they're going to be a lot lighter than those 10x50s that Dean likes.
Hey, I always go big. You know, I go on the big side. I want to see everything up there.
So telescopes, of course, are a lot harder. Were you going to comment on telescopes, Dean?
I was going to let you go first.
Yeah,
I'll go second on that one.
That's even binoculars are one thing because they're really adaptable to lots of uses. Telescopes are a whole lot harder question. It depends so much on what you intend to do with them. Do you want something that's portable that you're going to move it around, or do you want something that's just going to stay on the patio all the time, and what level of technology are you looking for? I usually suggest people look for low technology telescopes to start with. There's all kinds of computerized ones that you can buy these days, and they span a great range in serviceability and reliability. And if you really just want to start in astronomy, then a small Dobsonian reflector, small meaning maybe 6 or 8 inches aperture, that's the diameter of the mirror. Those are the things. Those are good starter telescopes. There are a number of good kits out there. They tend to be better equipped than a lot of the refractor, the introductory refractor type telescopes out there. They come with better, more practical eyepieces. And a Dobsonian is a very sturdy, easy to use mount. So that's generally what I would suggest if you shop around. A really good maker, I like to send people to Orion Optics. And so if you just Google for Orion Optics, I don't want to say their website or I'll probably get it wrong because there's a couple of variations on it. But that's where I would send people.
All right.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. I think Dobsonian's reflectors are a good way to go. And Celestron is another reputable brand. So Orion and Celestron are probably the best ones. Computerized stuff, maybe you want to steer clear of, at least initially. And size is also a thing too, because I have got one that's portable, fits in my car nicely. And then I've got one that weighs 85 pounds that just sits in my living room taking up space because it's I have to really think about if I want to take it out. Definitely lots of options there. But Orion and Celestron are probably the two places you want to go.
Let's go to Russ in Olmsted County, Minnesota. Hi, Russ.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I was hearing you wondering about the night sky, and I'm an expert on two groups of constellations, the Big Dipper and the others. I was a park ranger in Utah in Canyonlands, where you can't see a city light anywhere at night. And it's just great for stargazing. And I was talking about the stars for what little I knew. And there was a lady there who held her cell phone up and took a picture. And all of the stars and constellations were named. And I was taken aghast because what a way to find it out. And She said, well, it's probably on your phone, too. It's on most of them that they come that way. So if you find a good place to see the stars and want to know what they are, you can do it with your cell phone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The technology, there's a lot of cool technology out there. Yeah, I see people do that all the time. I've seen more mixed results with that. People hold the phone up and an app lays it out for them on a chart. And at that point, it can get iffy because depending on how much of the sky you've got zoomed in or out on your phone, trying to translate that into what you see in the sky takes a little bit of practice. But yeah, there are a number of really good apps that will do that. They'll lead you around the sky. They're really great.
Yeah. Dean, comment?
Yeah, they are pretty cool. Pretty much any of them. There's some called like Star Walk, Sky Safari, Go Sky Watch. They all pretty much do the same thing. You aim your phone up there and it'll tell you what it is. They're pretty good. They're not quite ready to replace Jim and myself as your guide out there in the sky. But, you know, if I'm not out there with you, a phone's probably your second best thing.
I have a Star Tracker, and it has a song that is associated with it. And butt clicked it once, and it's sort of this heavenly song comes on.
Yes.
And I'm suddenly hearing this song, and I'm wondering, what in the world am I dying now? What's happening?
That's what's the astronomer soundtrack. Whenever Jim and I are walking around in public, that's always playing in our heads.
Oh, boy.
You know, yeah, as astronomers, that's what's always going on.
I turn the audio off as soon as I start that thing up.
Oh, well, it caught me by surprise because I hadn't heard I somehow managed to click the audio on as well as, anyway.
The soundtrack of your life.
Let's go to Frank in Madison. Frank, hi.
Hi, this is Frank. I actually am a member of the Madison Astronomical Society, so I come down to Space Place every month.
Hi, Frank.
For the meetings. Hi, how you doing, Jimmy? So, I've seen the total solar eclipse, and that has to be the most exciting experience I've had. But I had one that actually rivaled that about 25 years ago. I was going to go out to view the Perseid meteor shower, and a friend of mine came by late at night and said, well, no, we can't see it. It looks like it's cloudy outside. And I looked up and I said, oh, wait a second, hold on. I got fooled by this once before. So we went out anyway. We went out to the observatory that's out west that the UW has. Nice place to that we could observe. And as we went out there, I saw, these are not clouds. These are spectacular aurora borealis. They got better as we went out. And so we laid down on the grass all night. And we watched a fantastic Perseid meteor shower and the best aurora borealis I've ever seen. It must have been actually at our location because it covered most of the sky.
Wow. I've never seen anything like it.
Good boy. That's really cool. I'm 25 years ago, I was around here. I don't remember that, but I must have missed that one or something. That sounds wonderful, Frank.
Yeah,
it really is the only thing that can rival total solar eclipse is the auroras. I mean, that's the only thing in the ballpark as far as coolest things to see in astronomy. So so glad you got to see that.
Yeah, thanks, Frank. Appreciate it. Well, Michael in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Michael.
Hello, Larry. This is Michael in Madison, and I just want to tell you about an experience I had in Colorado about 20 years ago when I was archery hunting with four or five other guys for elk in the Colorado mountains. And they all took off, and I'm the oldest of all of them. I'm 80 now. And we all agreed to meet back at camp at dark. And I got back earlier. It was a real nice evening, and it was still light in the sky. And I just went out to where I know they were going to come back. And I look up in the sky, beautiful, and a couple of stars I could see. And all of a sudden, to my left is this cloudy thing rolling through the sky. And it had to be like less than a half a mile from me. And it was all cloudy. and it was moving so fast. And I thought, oh my God! And I didn't have my camera with me, and all of a sudden, it went over the mountain range I was standing next to, and it just like two big boulders just crashing into each other. And I heard it boom, and then it was boom, 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 and I couldn't believe it. And it obviously was a rock coming through our atmosphere. And just beautiful to see, and it's a loud, loud boom. I've never seen anything like that or heard anything like that before.
Wow. You must sounds like an audible bolide. There are reports of those, but it's pretty rare to actually hear one. And I don't know. It's hard to tell from your description. You can't really tell by looking at them how close they are to you. But you were pretty lucky to see something at that range.
Yeah, Dean, you're nodding too.
Yeah, you see something like that, a big meteor going across the sky. I know they always look like they're very, very close to you, but when they're lit up, they're about 40 or 50 miles up. That's where the deceleration happens. That's where the big bright flashes happen. And so generally speaking, yeah, you think they're going to come right down next to you, but they're way up there. And then as far as the sound goes, maybe you can confirm this, or usually the sound, there's a big lag. So the big one that happened in Russia about 10 years ago in Chelyabinsk, the flash happened, and then 90 seconds later, then the sonic boom happens. And so it's about a 90 second delay from the brightest flash to when the sonic booms usually happen. That's how long it takes to go those 40, 50 miles. So, but it's still a cool thing to see, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. You'll never forget that, for sure, Michael. Thank you so much for calling. Dean, in addition to your July 9th appearance at UW Space Place, you'll also give a talk on July 11th at the Yerkes Observatory in Williams Bay.
Yeah, not too far away from folks in Madison. If you haven't been to the Yerkes Observatory, this is the place where the largest refracting telescope is in the world, made in the 1890s. This thing is huge, and it's just this really cool building and cool observatory. So I'll be there on July 11th for their open house. So we'd love to have people come out and see that. People who haven't seen the Yerkes Observatory. Mm-hmm. They've done some amazing restoration work and really cool event there. I'll also be there on the 10th doing a talk as well. So you can just go to yerkesobservatory.org and find out some more information about that. That's a great place to go and not too far from you all.
And Jim, back to you for a minute for the July 9th appearance. What time in the UW Space Place in Madison?
Sure, right. That's right, at UW Space Place, which is at 2300 South Park Street in Madison, not on the UW campus, but 2300 South Park Street. It'll be at 7. The talk will be at 7 p.m. So we'll be open, of course, before and after that, say from about 6:30 or so, and then afterwards. So that's free and open to the public. So we invite everybody to come down. And again, I agree with Dean. If you haven't been to Yerkes, it's a lot of people don't realize that the biggest refracting telescope in the world is right here in Wisconsin. It's down the road there in Williams Bay. And so that's a great place to go visit.
And who runs that now?
So it's used to be the University of Chicago, but a few years ago, 2018, I think, or 2019, they turned that over to a local foundation, the Yerkes Future Foundation, which is based right there in Williams Bay. So it's now truly a Wisconsin institution based right here in Wisconsin. And it's an amazing, both historical from the standpoint of astronomical history, but it's also beautiful right there on the shore of Geneva Lake.
Thumbs up to that, and thumbs up to both of you. Thank you so much for being with us today. A lot of fun, as always, and I hope you'll come back and do this again. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Larry.
Absolutely. Keep looking up, everybody.
Jim Lattice, director of the UW Space Place, also a faculty associate in astronomy with the UW College of Letters and Sciences. And Dean Regas, author, YouTuber, former outreach astronomer at the Cincinnati Observatory, and current host of the podcast Looking Up with Dean Regas for Cincinnati Public Radio. Great to have them with us. Coming up, we're going to be talking with the author of True North. I'm Larry Mehler.